And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, little buddies. You can just call me Bill Cosby, because it's time for a Jell-O pudding pop. Get it? Yes, Italian movies. Or, hey, get this. You could call me Orson Welles, because I got a big gallon jug of Jell-O wine. We shall sell no crime before it's time. I got a million of... Hey, where are you going?
Bienvenido, and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am one of your co-hosts, Luke Giaconetti, and let me introduce my other co-host today. First, the one man I don't blame for the cold weather in the north during the autumn and winter, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Hello.
And all...
I did help create the Frankenstorm, though.
Yes, clearly that had your name written all over it. And also, let me introduce my other co-host, the one man I do not blame for the name of the NBA franchise in the state of Oklahoma, Mr. Sean Engel.
Ciao, Bella. And by Bella, I don't mean the damn person from Twilight.
Just about to jump on that, yeah.
You know, it's I feel bad for Kristen Stewart. It must be hard to live your life without a personality.
Yeah.
So. Well, not that you would notice, yeah.
And tonight we're continuing our look at Italian horror films with the second film in our series, directed by Mario Bava. The film is La ragazza che sapeva troppo, which translates to The Girl Who Knew Too Much. This film was made in 1963 and is generally recognized by critics as the first Italian giallo film. And we've talked about this last time, but just real quick, in case anyone missed our previous episode, giallo is a genre which mixes elements of thriller, exploitation, and horror, and it was so named because during the 1920s and into the 1930s, the Italian equivalent of the pulp fictions or penny dreadfuls that you would get in the United States or the UK were called giallos because they were printed on paper that was yellow, and giallo is the Italian word for yellow. And this is a genre that has retained some popularity in Italian cinema, and this is the first one, and it's you can see a lot of the trappings of things that will become almost tropes of this genre right here in this film.
Oh, definitely. A lot of the things, you know, especially the way the women are shaded, the lighting on the women's faces, the use of the knife imagery. It's in some of the movies that I've seen, giallo films I've seen after this, definitely take from this film. Mm-hmm.
See, I don't have really much... I don't know if I've really seen an official giallo film, so all of my touch points when I was watching this were Hitchcock.
Yes.
I was watching this Definitely. Going, oh my God, this is like early, it's like an early black and white Italian Brian De Palma, sort of, in a way.
Well, yes, Brian De Palma pretty much ripped off everything that Hitchcock did, but that's for another show.
Hey, now, remember, if your budget is more than $10 million, it's not a ripoff, it's an homage.
That's true.
Yep. Hey, let's get really classy and call it an homage. An omelette du homage.
Just real quick for, again, in case anyone hasn't seen it, just going to give the quick story of The Girl Who Knew Too Much. Our heroine is Miss Nora Davis, who is an American who is on a vacation in Rome. And she has a very bad first night because the old family friend that she is staying with manages to die the very night that she arrives. And running out into the piazza in front of the house that her friend lives in, trying to get to the hospital to get help, she is then mugged and her purse stolen. When she's mugged, she falls and hits her head. And in her haze, after hitting her head, she witnesses a woman being murdered, being stabbed in the back with a kitchen knife. And she sees, she thinks she sees the face of the killer, but she just, you know, she's found the next morning and everyone assumes that it was a delusion or a dream or that she was an alcoholic. And so she and her cute doctor friend, who is played by John Saxon, set off to try and get down to the truth of what happened the night that she was attacked. A pretty standard giallo setup. One of the, an interesting thing that's seen here. Hitchcock would do this, and other giallo directors would do this too. When she falls, she hits her head. When she's seeing the murder, Bava does a weird effect with the film and makes it look kind of hazy and rolling a little bit. And a recurring theme a lot in giallo is that the main character will witness a murder, will witness the killer killing someone else. But then they can't trust their memory or they can't trust their senses. Mm-hmm. They're impaired in some way or they're too far away or they see something that doesn't make sense. And that's right here on display because she's obviously had a very rough evening. And then she's fallen and smacked her head on the piazza wall.
And she's also a huge fan of mystery novels.
Yes.
Yeah, she's also... Yeah, the first thing we see her doing when she's getting on the... when she's riding on this plane, TWA, over to Italy, is she's reading a Gialli novel. You know, what... like, The Knife, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
So she's obviously a person who's kind of, you know, already suspect to... look for these kind of things in normal circumstances. So,
and she's 20. She's a 20-year-old woman in Italy, in the early 60s. She's probably viewed as being who loves mystery novels as just being, you know, ditzy and impressionable.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as an American as well.
And an American 20-year-old female, you know. So it when in fact she's pretty much the person with their shit together the most in this entire movie. She's the one who's got her wits about her.
And that again, getting back to what you had mentioned earlier, Chris, that makes me think of Hitchcock. Because Hitchcock's women were always, they were always on the ball, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think of Grace Kelly in Rear Window.
Mm-hmm. You know,
of all the characters in Rear Window, she's the only one that behaves like a normal person. You know, who thinks things through,
right.
Normal person, you know, and Nora's the same way because she knows what she saw. And so she gets very, she gets very mad when, you know, the doctors and the detectives repeatedly say, oh, she's an alcoholic. She was hallucinating, you know, she's having delusions and she's only in her 20s, you know, and I love her very diva response in the hospital when, Dr. Marcello comes up, and again, that's John Saxon. He says, "Get me out of here, or I'll cause a scene."
the doctor, he kind of annoyed me. He was kind of a bimbo in this.
Yeah,
you know, it was funny because it was going against the, you know, usually in these movies you had the doctor is going to be the one who, you know, gets her out of a jam or whatever, but this guy's just kind of useless. He gets to run in afterwards, and all he's really good for is sort of, like, taking her out on the town and trying to get in her pants.
Yeah.
Basically, is his only use in this story, which is kind of refreshing, you know, to see her work all the way through it without, you know, and having a detective and a doctor as the two, you know, ostensibly male leads or, you know, dominant male characters in it, and both of them being completely useless.
Yeah, they're both bumblers.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that's a testament to Bava and, you know, him allowing the female character to be the one who is the smartest person in the room. A lot of times, from what I've heard, Italian filmmakers tend to get this idea of, you know, being sort of misogynistic and treating women as, you know, well, as chattel. And in this film, Bava promotes the female character as the most intelligent person in the room, which is a really nice, which kind of disproves that whole idea.
Yeah.
And with the romance with the man, she's not goo-goo-eyed over him. She's interested.
Yeah.
When he lays on the Italian charm, you know, she's just sort of like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
I did very much like... when he drops her off at her place the first time, and she kind of throws her hand at him for him to kiss it. I love that. That's very, she's on to his game. You know, like you say,
right.
She kind of plays off his charms, and she's obviously in control of that. Whereas Marcello's very kind of puppy dog in love with her.
Yeah. You know? Well, what did she tell? She told him basically, you know, when I'm calling you in to come in, you'll know by the tone of my voice.
Yeah.
And I thought, and that's like the, you know, seeing the loaded gun on the table, I'm like, all right, there's going to be a romantic scene at the end. I can see it now. This is a setup for the romantic scene at the end where she's like, come on inside. Never happened. It was awesome. She was like, all right, see you later.
Yeah, and it's funny because we've talked about a lot of the more amusing aspects, and there is some comedy in this,
mm-hmm.
which was almost completely absent from Black Sunday. But this is again, that's another aspect, I think, that talks to the Hitchcock influence, because Hitchcock,
yes,
have a lot of relief in his films generally, because, you know, one of Hitchcock's main tricks was you get everybody relaxed a little bit and then you twist the knife in the back kind of thing here.
Oh, definitely. Well, and one of the big scenes that, you know, I thought was incredibly comedic was when Nora was in the house by herself, and she decided, well, to keep this killer away, what I'll do is I'll put talcum all over the floor, so if they walk on the floor, they'll slip, and then I'll run string all throughout the room, so they'll come in and trip on it. And then, of course, the supposed killer or whatever walks in, it's the police. Then after that, the doctor follows him in and basically trips through all the string that she's laid as a trap and breaks his finger. So it's a ridiculous setup for her being really, of her being really paranoid, but it does break the mood of the sort of tension that you're getting, you know, of the shadows of the person in the background. So it's really, it really does break the tension.
But at the same time, it demonstrates that again, that she's the one who's got her act together, because she knows she's vulnerable. I mean, the narrator says that when she comes home, because she was alone in the house. It was the perfect setup for the killer. So mm-hmm. she takes actions to defend herself. And, you know, had it been the killer, he would have gotten tangled up. Her plan worked. It just so happened that it wasn't the killer. It was John Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are some giallos that we'll look at later that do use different levels of comic relief to try and break the mood a little bit. Deep Red has a couple of moments real early that kind of break the mood, and then they are purposefully abandoned. But we'll talk about that film in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
What I really like this is just the way this is shot. Again, this is another film that's black and white. And what's interesting is, compared especially to Black Sunday, there were a lot of scenes in this that were shot in natural light.
Yes.
And can really tell, especially on the DVD, you can really tell the difference between the ones that are shot in natural light and the ones that are on a set where Bava did the lighting. And I love that. I look so, you know, they're almost like two worlds. There's the world that it's daytime when they're out in the piazza, or when they're out seeing the sights, or they're out on the beach. And then there's the world at night when they're in the apartment, or when they're in the piazza when it's lit, I know, by Bava. And it looks like two different worlds. You know, they don't even look like the same.
Right.
And it is. It's the exact same piazza, and it looks like two different places.
Mm-hmm.
When at nighttime, all of his outdoor nighttime shots, you know, they isolate the light to just certain parts of the screen. So it takes, I mean, basically during the daytime, it's almost like a travelogue.
Yeah.
There's like sweeping shots of, you know, the Colosseum, and then sightseeing and very, very scenic sort of setups. But at night, it becomes cramped again,
mm-hmm.
like being inside. And all the interiors in this are kind of cramped,
yep.
or shot in close-up. Like, even when they're in a nice big open restaurant, it's all shot, you know, really close to the table with all their faces in the frame, mm-hmm. and not much background.
Well, and as being a person who actually has been to Italy, that is a lot of the way Rome is. there's not a lot of open spaces in Rome. I mean, you can go to the Colosseum or go to the Circus Maximus, and there's a large area out there. But when you're in buildings and hotels and people's houses, there's a big economy of space. So he captured that really well. And I agree with you. The daytime shots of this are pretty much a travelogue. And it was really nice. I hearken this back to that awful movie Angels and Demons, that the one thing that was good about that movie was they got the sights and the feel of Rome really well. And this movie does the same thing. This movie does it a lot better because you don't have Tom Hanks running around trying to foil an antimatter blast.
I think we're all better off for not having Tom Hanks running around trying to foil an antimatter blast.
True. Yep, no Tom Hanks and no antimatter in this movie.
Yes.
And, the other shot on the piazza that I really liked was right at the beginning when she runs out and after her friend dies, and just the absolute depth of field.
Mm-hmm.
So, she's all the way in the background, and we can very clearly see all the steps on the piazza, and we can see the fencing and the walls. And then in the foreground, we've got the mugger, and everything is in focus. He's got this really big depth of field that shows the size of this piazza, but also shows all the elements interacting at once. And then she's coming down, and the robber is moving off. He's moving off the frame, and then he comes back in. And it's just wonderfully shot. It's a nice long shot. But the depth is something that you don't see a lot nowadays, in my opinion. I think a lot of modern filmmakers would rather just do a lot of, besides doing a lot of cuts, don't like to show depth in the frame. And that's something I've always liked, because that... It's almost like Robert Altman is real good for showing that frame. Mm-hmm. To me, it says you've got to really plan your shot, because everybody's got to be moving to
right.
parts, and you can't hide something by putting it out of focus. If you can see everything in clear relief, it's like the camera becomes our eyes. See everything.
You can't have that Nike logo on someone's shoes in 1943 or whatever. You have to have every detail right.
And again, that was one of the early shots in this film. That's maybe about 10 minutes into the film that it just looks so wonderful, especially in black and white. It's so stark, and there's so much stark imagery in this film, the light and the shadow, the imagery is what you take away more than the story, which is admittedly a little thin, but you take away the images from this film, and that's really, I think, where a lot of the influence comes in.
Yeah, the story is a pretty standard murder mystery that could easily be done by like Sue Grafton. In fact, I was listening to the commentary, and a lot of people, the guy who was commenting on the movie, said that the idea of the alphabet murders was obviously taken by Sue Grafton and many other writers and done in their type of books. But the one thing you can take away from this is the imagery, and it's really wonderfully set, wonderfully lit, and just really, it's a really nice film to look at.
Mm. There's an early bit when Nora witnesses the murder, and you can very clearly see the victim, and then the killer is coming up in the shadow, and the killer's face is completely covered in shadow, but we can just see the glint on the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Just very barely. That's really striking.
My first thought was when you saw the killer's face, I'm like, it's Orson Welles.
Now he's way too thin to be Orson Welles.
Yes. Well, early Orson Welles, but early Orson Welles didn't have that much hair.
Yeah, but go on.
I love this movie. It's funny, a little behind the scenes on this one is this one was kind of a hard one to track down for a while, and then it showed up on Netflix, so we sort of lucked out. So if you want to see it, it's on Netflix. It's also on YouTube in Italian if you speak Italian. But I'm a sucker for Hitchcock. I love Hitchcock, and I'm also a sucker for a well-shot, well-planned-out movie, and this had all of it. And it was different. This felt more like an homage to Hitchcock than De Palma, which almost seemed like a, not as much of a ripoff, but a ramping up and sometimes like a recreation. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to technically recreate this sort of shot that Hitchcock would do, whereas Bava was more approaching a lot of the themes of Hitchcock. Like, at the very beginning, just really established it so much with the guy giving her the pack of cigarettes, and then they carry him off in the airport, and they're like, you know, we've been following you, you've been smuggling marijuana in packs of cigarettes, and she realizes that she has one of his packs of cigarettes that he gave her. And so she's trying to, like, drop it on the ground to get rid of it, and, you know, a security guard, cop, or whatever, notices it and hands it back to her. Total Hitchcock moment of somebody who's innocent, you know, getting caught up in something that they didn't want to, and all of a sudden having the, you know, a little tension with the authorities.
And especially a pretty blonde girl, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That totally is a Hitchcock moment. And you think about it, this is 1963. You know, Vertigo was 1958. North by Northwest, 1959. Psycho, 1960. You know, this, and again, we alluded to The Man Who Knew Too Much was 1956. So we're clearly right in the prime output.
Right.
Alfred Hitchcock's popular, you know, I mean, all of his films were well regarded. But it wasn't until really you get to, in my opinion, you know, Strangers on a Train is 1951. Once you get to Strangers on a Train, then his films start becoming, you know, much more popular with audiences, and they're always popular with critics. So I think, yeah, it's pretty clear to me watching this that, you know, making this in 1963, titling it The Girl Who Knew Too Much, and, you know, including a lot of these kind of Alfred Hitchcock-isms, it was clearly an homage to Hitchcock. At least that's my reading of it. Especially also being shot in black and white the way it is.
And there was a psychological psycho aspect to it, you know, somebody who is psychologically unsound.
I was going to say also the gender bending, playing with our expectations of roles.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that psycho thing was for is that, you know, Janet Leigh, she looks like she could have been, you know, Hitchcock's girl in any one of his movies, but she's, you know, as I like to say, she's a stone cold bitch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she gets hers, and then the movie takes kind of a strange turn. Whereas here, we're expecting, like you said, Chris, you know, we've got, you know, a handsome young doctor, a, you know, girl from America who's a pretty blonde. It's like, oh, okay, well, she's going to be the girl in trouble, and he's going to be the hero. And we get that.
Romance, yep.
So it's, again, similar in setup, not to the severity of Psycho, where they kill her off, but certainly playing with the expectations of the audience based on the gender roles that we normally would see assigned in a typical Hollywood thrill in the early 60s.
Well, and also the gender roles are kind of reversed for the murderer as well. And I don't know if we want to reveal the ending of it, or spoil it, but there is that sort of reversal of who you think the murderer is actually twisted around. So I like that aspect of the movie as well.
Yeah, I really like that too. And that's that the swerving on the identity is, again, another now time-honored tradition in the giallo genre. We would see this over and over, where they really, really sell you on one character, and then it's completely twisted.
Yep, they give you a red herring, or sometimes even two or three red herrings.
And they're always red herrings that aren't obvious.
Yes, that make you think, okay, yeah, I see what they're trying to say, but it's really this, yeah.
And then it's you know, curtain number three, usually. the other interesting thing, just a referential thing than anything else, I like that Nora's friend Laura, she specifically, which is Italian for Laura, you'll be surprised to know. She specifically says that their house is not very big because it used to be a sculptor's studio. And this only really stuck out to me because art and artists, either artists or musicians, usually play a role in a giallo for whatever reason. Either the main character is an artist, or they're friends with an artist, or there's art involved or music involved in some way. And it's a little throwaway line, essentially, just explaining, oh, it's not big, it used to be a studio, but it ties in again with the art world. And you know, sculpture is a is a tactile medium. There's a lot of tactility to this film. You were talking earlier, Sean, about the knife imagery. And that kind of, again, that's a very physical sort of imagery. And that's very common. That would get used over and over throughout the 70s, even into the, you know, the last, the dying breeds of the Golden Age giallo was 1980 or so. And, you know, so that struck me as just, that there's a little throwaway line connecting it with an art form, which, again, would just be something revisited. It's just, it's interesting the way that trends like that develop. They're very rarely consciously done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people kind of have the same, they're kind of on the same wavelength with their thoughts, and then trends just start emerging.
I was just going to say, it's really hard to do that stuff consciously,
yeah.
You know, because as it's evolving. I mean, people sometimes, you know, people try to do stuff like that consciously and start trends and stuff, but a lot of the times it ends up being really awkward, you know?
Yeah. When people try and do something in filming and try and add it non-organically, it usually sticks out really poorly. I can't think of an exact example right now, but yeah, if something doesn't actually just come naturally from the filmmaking or naturally from the way they're shooting the film or scripting it, it obviously does come off a bit hinky.
Yeah, and you know, that's... There's plenty of hinkiness in giallo, as you will see. There's always a kid like that, the doorkeeper. She just cracks me up because she talks a mile a minute, and she conveys a lot of information. This is a stock character in a lot of type of different subgenres of murder mystery. But she is just hilarious in this. She's got her one scene, and I think she's getting paid by the word.
She was essentially the Italian movie version of the expositional news network.
Yeah.
You know, she gave all the exposition that Nora would need to know what's going on, and you know, then just went away.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, by the way, I'm going out of town. You should stay here. Yeah. But in the psychological aspect of it, you know, that sort of fits with her character. Well, you know, she was probably a bit manic, you know, so she was on the up when she's talking to Nora. And yeah, and then when she's on the down, well, we all know what happens with that. But this movie, I've seen it once, but I'm definitely gonna watch it again, because I could tell right away that it was gonna bear up to repeated viewings.
Yeah.
Because of just the little things. The guy with the cigarettes on the plane. That doesn't pay off till the end of the movie when she's like, I smoked one of those cigarettes. Maybe it was all a pot dream. And I'll tell you right now, no, it wasn't. There's no pot that's that good. It's going to do that, you know.
He's on end where you're waking up and going back to sleep. I don't know about that.
The guy gave her some bath salts or LSD on the plane. Okay, maybe I could pass it off all as a dream or a roofie or something, but... But
if he had given her bath salts, she'd have been running around Rome naked, stabbing people. So,
right.
She's got a totally different movie, and then
yeah, that's later on in Italian films that starts popping up.
And I do love the payoff to the marijuana cigarettes when she throws them away and says, "I'm never smoking again." The priest stops and picks them up. I love it.
Yeah.
It's like,
that was very Hitchcock, like a little stab at like religion or authority or something, because he picks him up and he sort of does a little guilty walk, shifty eyed, you know, walk away back into line with the other priest of just like, I wonder if anybody saw that.
Not doing anything here. Don't have any marijuana cigarettes here. Nope.
I also loved the very casual way that Landini, the reporter, just says that every article he wrote accused the Italian police of incompetence. And it's like, and yet they never said anything because they know it to be true. What's ever going to accuse the Italians of having the top crack police force?
As soon as you see their uniforms, it's just like, how do you function in that, you know, as a cop in that uniform? But I love at the very beginning when she goes to... Now, was that her aunt, or it was just like a family friend, wasn't it? The old lady at the beginning?
It was a family friend, yeah.
Family friend. When she goes to visit her, you know that old lady's dead, because the first time she sees her, she's got that, like, blanket over her like a ghost or like a death shroud. You know, and she's like, whoa, takes the shroud. And that's the first thing she saw. And I'm like, that old lady's done.
Yeah.
And that's some foreshadowing right there.
That was
really
good imagery done by Boffa. Yeah. They mentioned that, listening to commentary, they mentioned that as well, that the first scene you see of her is this white sheet over her, and she's sitting over this vapor pot to try and get herself to feeling better. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's pretty much an imagery of a ghost. Yeah, she's dead.
Shroud, yeah.
And what's funny is her name is Ethel. And anytime there's a dead person named Ethel, all I can think of is a song "Cold Ethel" by Alice.
So, all I can think of is this, the song "The Streak." Don't look at it, Ethel.
Now that would be a mashup if you could put those two songs together.
What the hell was that? What the hell was that guy's name that did "The Streak"?
Oh man,
he's a down home folksy country sort of guy.
Yep,
he still does stuff actually. Ray Stevens.
Yes.
So, like, I go to Ray Stevens, and you go to Alice Cooper.
I'll meet him on the golf course. It'll work out.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That, I tell you what, that the scene that when you know, Cold Ethel dies, also gets us a couple other really awesome bits. First off, I really love the jagged shadows that show up across Nora's face when she's in Ethel's apartment. And because anytime she goes to the window or looks around, it's the shadow coming through, I'm guessing, the blinds. But it just looks like just jagged, like claw marks almost across her face.
Yeah.
I really like that because you see like her one eye will be in light and her other eye will be in shadow. And we're able to see part of her mouth, but not her whole mouth. It just makes the whole thing look very unworldly.
Well, it also comes into the whole thing of the location being a character, you know, sort of thing. And that house is, that house, like, it offers up information to her in the form of that little closet, you know, dropping out the news clippings and stuff, and then stuff disappears. It's almost as if the house, it has a locked door.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just got the, it's almost, you know, if this wasn't a mystery story, if it was going to be on the horror side of it, like on the more supernatural side, it could have been a haunted house story, almost.
Yeah, old dark house kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. And like the murder she saw would have been something from the past. Although they do sort of toy with that in the book of saying, and it's actually the detective, a detective and a doctor, the two supposedly most rational people that you know you would think of, sitting there discussing, well, maybe what she saw was some sort of phantom from the past, because that could have been the girl who was murdered, you know, years and years ago. And I don't know if they're doing that just to sort of try to bullshit her into, you know, just enjoying the rest of her stay in Rome, or whether they were actually kicking that around. But
it is the Italian police, you know.
That's true.
It's like, Captain, what do you think? It's a ghost, sir. Oh, I guess we'll close that case.
Yeah, well, by the time the police got to her, when in the beginning, she'd already been robbed and witnessed a murder, and the murderer had time to mop up.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, and then, you know, get rid of all the evidence in the murder as well. The clippings of the newspaper article and the tape recorder. So, yeah, there's been plenty of shenanigans going on.
And what's the first thing the cops do? They accuse her of being a drunk.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, and she didn't even...
Yeah, because a guy put two drops of liquor in her mouth.
Yeah, oh, obviously, yeah.
Clearly.
The Italian police force sucks.
The other thing that scene where Ethel dies gives us is we do get Nora in her awesome friggin' nightgown there.
Oh, my. Well, and that's another trope of the giallo films, is that they do tend to get some of the most attractive females to be main characters in their films.
I mean,
really nice looking women.
Well, I think and a lot of those women sort of seem patterned after the archetypal Hitchcock.
Hitchcock girl. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Girl. Yeah. Blonde.
Stetsko, you know.
Yeah, especially in something like this, it's a mystery. If it was horror or supernatural, you probably tend to get more women with dark hair.
Yeah.
Because they're more evil looking, you know, mm-hmm. more Tura Satana style.
I mean, look at Letizia Roman's face. she looks like a Hitchcock girl. She's got kind of that high cheekbone look.
The hairstyle, well, that's the hairstyle of the day, but still, yeah. You know.
1963, every woman had that hairstyle, but except Jackie O, I guess. But, you know, then the mouth, you know, kind of the shape of her mouth. And she looks like she could have been, this could have been a Hitchcock film, just filmed in Italian, from as far as the cast is concerned. Because John Saxon has kind of that Hitchcockian lead.
Yes, look. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Classic contract player look, you know?
Cary Grant style, yeah, young Cary Grant style.
Cary Grant or James Stewart, yeah.
Yeah.
Young and dashing, but a little scholarly and, you know, sort of in those days, leading men were always sort of James Bondian Renaissance men of like, try some, you know, what kind of man reads Playboy? Try some of this fine wine and...
And, oh, by the way, I'm a black belt in judo, you know?
Right.
I will say that versus, you know, I'll take John Saxon versus Cary Grant in a fight any day of the week, I think.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, the lower the budget involved, the tougher the actors, I would say, involved usually.
Had to fight for it.
Yeah, you know, until you get, you know, like when you get into the, like, cheap movies in America, you got your Danny Trejo's in there who's, like, 68 years old, but he'd still, you know.
I was going to say, that was Charles Bronson's gig for a long time, you know.
Right.
You know, everybody on the internet loves to put over Chuck Norris. I said, hell.
Well, Chuck Norris is, like, the icon of ridiculous manliness now, you know. He's a meme of it now, you know, and yeah.
But, you know, Charles Bronson took out more punks than anybody else in film history, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I mean, he kills like 200 people in just the 5 Death Wish movies.
You want me to take this tangent way off the rails for just a second? I was talking to the hair metal hero the other day, and he informed me, speaking of old action stars, that Arnie just signed up to do another Conan movie.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on some news site that they're thinking about, you know, actually doing a sort of King Conan type movie.
And see, that actually could work because, again, to go even further off tangent, if you read some of Howard's later stories with Conan where he is King Conan, you know, his son is a character that's involved there. So he is an older man, you know.
Yeah, he does get to go into his August years.
Yeah. And
it's going to go either way, though. But I'll tell you what. If it goes, if it's horrible or if it's awesome, either way, I'm on board.
I was going to say, it won't be middle of the road.
No. It won't walk out of it going, yeah, that was okay.
It's all right.
Yeah, obviously, the latest Conan movie didn't really give you that middle of the road feel. I'm pretty certain for most people it was...
I never saw it, and it seemed like it was in the theaters for maybe a quarter of a second, you know, long enough to play the credits, and then it was gone.
Well, I will say this. As long as Arnie can still sit hunched over with his his chin in his hand and sitting with the crown and get Mako to say that, you know, the jeweled crown of Aquilonia did sit upon troubled brow, I think we'll be okay. Yeah. I want Mako to narrate my funeral if at all possible, but I think he's a lot older than me, so I don't know if that's from a timeline standpoint.
Well, I ask, and if anybody is a regular listener has noticed a hair metal hero could make it today, I'll interject a few hair metal heroisms in it. I like, when he wrote me that, I'm like, how is he physically going to do that? Because he's not the homunculus, gigundous Arnie that he used to be, and he's just like human growth hormone. And then I was like, maybe a little CGI, but
yeah, that's funny.
I heard they were kicking around another Terminator movie with him, but you know, you can't have an old Terminator. It's like you can't do another next generation movie because you can't have an old Data. What the hell would that be? How the hell did that work, you know?
Well, unless you do it like, you know, maybe that make that the story. Why is
Data changed his skin so that people would look at him with more respect as an older person to reflect his age or something? But yeah, bullshit. you know. So I'm going to be very curious. But anyway, Mario Bava.
Yeah.
You like that smooth segue?
Awesome. That's,
I was going to say, you went to the same Segway school that the guys on the Fantasticast went to, didn't you?
I've got to ask, Luke. Are these films are these films actually recorded, or is the dialogue actually done in Italian originally, or is it done in English and they dubbed the Italian over it?
Do you know
about that?
Yeah, this one's kind of is a little bit like Black Sunday was, in that this one, John Saxon and Leticia Roman did their parts in English and then were dubbed, and a lot of the other cast was Italian, and they did it in they would work in Italian, and it's not uncommon for this in a lot of European films, just because you'll get the way that the work visas work in Europe, from my understanding, is that it's very easy to go from, say, France to Italy to shoot a film, and then if you don't speak Italian, just play it in French and they'll dub you, kind of thing. There's a couple of scenes where it's very, very obvious that Leticia Roman is dubbed. The scene where she's talking on the phone with her mother is very clearly, because she's using a lot of kind of colloquial Americanisms, don't match anywhere near what they're translating that to. They're literally translating that to into Italian, you know? So yeah, it's a thing that you kind of make do with what you got. And it's funny because I've never seen the English version of Girl Knew Too Much. I've only ever watched the Italian one. The English version was known primarily as The Evil Eye here in
the Evil Eye.
Yeah.
Again, makes no sense. There's no real eye imagery that is, you know, it makes it sound like a Fulci film talking about the evil eye. And I don't know if Leticia Roman or John Saxon's voices are heard in the English version, but they did play their roles in English. It's not like sometimes in a Japanese film, if Nick Adams is in your Toho movie, and Nick Adams, he was another Hollywood guy, you know, and he spent a lot of time in Japan, and he would play his part in, Nick Adams could actually speak decent Japanese, but he would play his role in English. And then when it was released in Japan, they would dub him into Japanese. And then when Toho would dub the film back into English, he would redub his lines.
Wow.
Nick Adams dubbing Nick Adams.
Hey, it's extra. Yeah, it's more work, you know?
Yeah, well,
I guess. Good, yeah.
Is that he could play his lines off of the other dubbers.
Right, right.
And, sounds.
He'd listen to the dub and do his lines from the dub, so it was sort of that English thing where, you know, you'd be translating the translation of the translation.
It does lead to some absolutely great moments. I won't get into it here. It's obscure even for Earth Destruction Directive, but I mentioned real briefly Nora talking on the phone with her mother. The other phone scene, when she gets called and is taunted over the phone by the killer, this is something else, again, that would become an absolute trope of giallo genre. In Tenebrae, we see this over and over again in Tenebrae, and which is another one we'll be covering later. And it's the same kind of thing here, just the killer calling the main character just to taunt them. Now, in this case, it's very specific because she's supposedly going to be the next victim. So it's a very specific type of taunt. But I think it's that the lack of personal direct contact. You know, back then, before we had, instant messaging or texting or, electronic communication, the phone was the most impersonal form of personal communication you could have. And still allow, one-on-one response. You know, writing a letter, I guess, would be less personal. But, if the killer writes it on their stationery, you kind of know who they are,
You got their stationery, the postmark or something. And those, I remember back in the day where, in bad crime movies, you would have someone call the operator and go, "Operator, have the police trace that call." But in reality, you couldn't do that. So, like, a phone call was truly anonymous coming into your house. You didn't know, I remember the days before caller ID, and now everybody has a cell phone, and what pops up is
name and,
their name and number and everything. So it's harder to be anonymous these days. But if you had somebody's phone number, you could just terrorize them until they got a court order. To trace your call, and then you probably had to stay on the line for a certain, you know, according to the movies anyway, you had to stay on the line for a certain amount of time before they could trace you anyway.
You're not talking experience. No, you don't. That's all from the movies that you look at, Chris.
I made a few prank calls back in my, you know, that I always wonder about, you know, how they do prank calls these days and get away with it. Because, you know, back in the day, oh, we used to spend whole afternoons just with a phone book calling up Harry Pickle.
Or a gorilla.
Yeah, no, we actually had a Harry Pickle and right there in the phone book.
I had a Zontar Williams who used to subscribe to the newspaper I worked at.
Wow.
And it's like Zontar, the thing from Venus Williams?
You almost want to find that person and befriend them, it sounds like, more than taunt them on the phone. It sounds like you might not be able to taunt a Zontar, and maybe you might not want to taunt a Zontar on the phone.
Might, you know, zap you with his mind powers.
Well, that's what I was going to say. He doesn't need a court order. He'll just go into a meditation state, you know, a Doctor Strange-like state, and hunt you down.
Exactly. I was thinking he'd send his spectral form or his astral form about it.
Exactly.
Kind of choke you out.
Oh, man. I mentioned earlier the, and Sean, you said that giallo films tend to have some good-looking women in them. I absolutely love the fact that they take a completely gratuitous trip to the beach.
Oh, yes.
Patricia Roman has up in that tiny 1963 bikini. And it's like, yeah, Baba knows what side of the bread is buttered on right here, boy.
Completely unnecessary, but holy and ultimately wanted. I agree. Yeah, there's no reason for it to be in there, but I am so glad it was there.
Yeah.
Well, that was the only really good thing about that scene, because that's when he decided to, like, I'm going to kiss her for the first time. But for a woman who, whether real or imagined, is surrounded by a murder plot that you're, like, befriending and supposedly protecting, his approach to her on the beach, you know, whereas it was, you know, set up cinematically to be like, oh, maybe he's the killer, you know, because it was like, and it was far enough along in the movie where, okay, maybe he could be revealing himself as a killer, but no, it was really his come on to kiss her. That's a really creepy way to kiss somebody who's been robbed and, you know, ended up in the hospital and had her
can't
die and thinks a murderer's after.
Yeah, it had that sort of feel that he was being a bit too aggressive. And yeah, that it did kind of lead on that he might not have the best motives in trying to make out with her. So,
well, he said something like, you know, now it's time to get it over with, you know, and as he very threateningly approaches her.
And I also took a special note of this, Chris, is that he uses the Captain Kirk kiss technique of mashing his face against grabbing her as hard as he can while he does it.
Closed mouth, just like, yes.
Because that is the most romantic way you can kiss a woman ever.
That's some erotic shit right there, let me tell you. Women love that shit.
That 50 Shades of Grey got nothing on this technique right there.
Sometimes you even grab the back of their head and, like, rotate it around a little bit.
Oh.
It's sweet, yeah. I always wondered about, yeah. Kissing styles in those old movies were just hilarious.
Yeah. You know, Chris, you mentioned her being in the hospital. The hospital scene also has some really interesting work with the POV shots of the camera. When we get Nora's POV, when she's looking up at everybody looking down at her.
Yes.
I really like this.
The first shot is the hoods of the nuns all parting apart. And she sees the image of the nuns, and her first question is, am I dead? Am I in heaven? So, you know, that's a really kind of interesting shot.
Yeah, it speaks to my mindset that all I could think of was the scenes in RoboCop where they're programming him. And we keep getting the little glimpses of Murphy when, you know, they take him online and take him offline.
Right, right.
and it's like almost that fisheye lens almost, because they just look kind of really looming down over her. And the one dad's like, oh, well, here we have a case of severe alcoholism.
Yeah.
I'm right here. I'm not.
Well, and also, look at her. All you have to do is look at her. And no, that's not a case of severe. Like, a case of severe alcoholism in a 20-year-old, it's like, well, it's like Lindsay Lohan or, yeah, you know, or something like that. You can see it, you know.
And but then the other POV shot is when she goes to the hotel to meet Landini for the first time, and she goes up the elevator, which is I love old fashioned elevators like that. I love scenes with old fashioned elevators for whatever reason, because they move so slowly, they're very dramatic. You know, the scene in Diamonds Are Forever with the elevator, I've always been a favorite of. But when she goes there, we get the POV of who we think is the killer. And again, this is something that we see a lot, not only in giallo, but in slasher films. This is very commonly shot this way, where we get their POV coming up behind the intended victim. And, you know, just the kind of almost ethereal shots, like the door opening without seeing a hand touch it.
Without, anything touching it, yeah.
And then you see the moving closer in, because it's just the camera is, you know, being carried, so we don't get the, you know, footsteps, we don't see the person because we're looking out of their eyes. Again, another shot that becomes a standard sort of thing in giallo. I thought it was done really well. It's used very sparingly. Sometimes you get kind of beaten over the head with it in certain films, and here it's just kind of done that one scene and it builds some suspense and then has a quick payoff, which I like. And again, I love that elevator.
We used to have a band practice space in a warehouse, and we had one of those an old freight elevator where, you know, first you pulled a big heavy door down, and then you pulled a grate across, and then you had the lever to go up or down. You know, you had to stop it at the floor. You know, it didn't just stop at the floor. You had to sort of slow down, and sometimes it didn't quite line up. I loved that. A lot of people did not love that, though.
Well, it's one of those. Looking at it now, it's one of those elements that I don't want to say dates the film, but it's one of those things that sets it in a certain time period. And it's like if you see a spiral staircase. You know, it automatically really sets the stage for you because you know, okay, well, that was something that was common, you know, when this was made. This is not something we see today. So at the time, it's modernist, but now it's retro. You know, that's the curse of being modern, right? You're always 5 minutes away from being 5 minutes ago, kind of thing.
Well, yeah, and there's also no way, like when you watch a movie like this one, there's no way of unless you're old enough to remember that time period, to watch that movie in the context of, you know, everything in it being new.
Yeah.
So it was like a movie of its time when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And
another Hitchcock trait right there.
Yes.
Hitchcock,
yes,
never shied away from showing the modern world.
Like Spielberg. That's what I think Spielberg and Hitchcock have in common a lot of times. You know, they're when you see their movies, it's a snapshot of that time. They're not afraid to like put products in the background, you know, or just stuff that you would have seen that a lot of times they scrub out of those movies because it might go out of style, it might, you know, or they don't want, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if your story takes place in 1963, as this one does, it should look like 1963. You know, I don't need a story to be timeless because it's going to take me out of the film if, you know, I see a 1960, you know, Fiat 500 in Rome in 1963. That doesn't take me out of the film. I notice it because, okay, that's a Fiat and that's supposed to be there.
Well, that's the thing. Watching the cars was fun. There were a lot of neat old European cars driving around.
And and the one woman they talked to specifically made reference to, oh, she leased a Fiat. That's a lot of money in 1963 in Italy. That's a lot of lire right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, we have anybody have any kind of closing thoughts before we finish up on this one, on The Girl Knew Too Much?
This was a good one. You know, like everyone said, it does have a lot of cues to Hitchcock, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. If you're wanting to make an homage to anyone, making homage to Hitchcock is a good thing to do, and this one does it probably the best that I've ever seen a film do it. So I'm liking it.
Yeah, I really like this movie, and to do an homage to Hitchcock, and to do it, you could do it successfully to people who are like, oh, bravo, nice homage to Hitchcock. But this one works as its own movie, too. You know, it isn't, you're not watching it going, ah, I'm watching a pseudo-Hitchcock movie or a knockoff or anything like that. It gets you into its story, and it's done, I mean, it's done with a lot of thought and style. It's not a cut-rate movie at all. It's very well thought out, insanely well lit, and the cinematography is awesome. And what Luke said earlier about lighting, whenever you saw the lighting in there, it looked a lot. You could see from Black Sunday, Mario Bava. So it's like, okay, this guy's got a visual style. So I'm really starting to dig Mario Bava from these two movies. I like this one a lot better than Black Sunday. Although I really liked Black Sunday. This one's one I'm going to watch probably like three or four more times.
Yeah, and I think this is also, we talk a lot about, you know, how do you get somebody into horror if they're not a horror fan? Well, the trick is you show them something that's not a horror movie.
Right.
Oh, and you know, I had it didn't work out. I'd wanted to watch this one with my wife because I knew that it wasn't. There's no, you know, there's no real violence. There's no gore. You know,
it's suspense. Yeah.
Suspenseful. Mm-hmm. It's well made, and there's levity too. So it's not just, you know, it's not just gloom and doom for 88 minutes either. So this was always one I'd point to if you've got a friend or a spouse or somebody that isn't, you know, I don't want to watch that, you know, Italian crap. You know, watch The Girl Who Knew Too Much, because it's just an enjoyable film. And we've talked about it the entire episode. There's so much in this that is in the same vein as Hitchcock. And one thing Hitchcock did was take, you know, this type of lurid genre material and make it palatable to a wide audience. And this film follows the same kind of approach, I think, in that this is palatable. Anybody can sit down and watch this and be entertained by it and be, you know, be a little scared from the suspense and get caught up in it and trying to figure out who done it. And ultimately, that's what a giallo is about. For all the flash and the violence and the pounding music and the other things that would become synonymous with giallo, at the end of the day, it's a whodunit. And this is a very well done version of a whodunit story. And I think it's and you can't go wrong checking this one out on Netflix.
Yeah, I'm glad that it finally did come to Netflix. I was lucky enough to find the DVD, but yeah, now that it's on Netflix, there is no excuse for anyone not to watch it.
And that actually is a pretty decent segue, because the next film we're going to be watching, the third film in our series by Mario Bava, is also available on Netflix, and I'm looking at it right now, so I know it's available for watching on Netflix. And the film is 1966 Kill Baby Kill, known as Operation Paura, which translates to Operation Fear. This is going to be our first film in color, as actually The Girl Who Knew Too Much was his last film in black and white. And again, it's on a Netflix watch instant. I believe it is available on DVD, but I'm not gonna say for sure after I got in trouble with the last one.
Well, the last one is available on DVD. It's just it could cost you.
Yeah,
I noticed.
So you folks will have to excuse me. I got the Mario Bava box set that Anchor Bay put out a number of years ago that has Black Sunday, Black Sabbath, The Girl Who Knew Too Much, Kill Baby Kill, and Knives of the Avengers. In it, I got the five of them. I just assumed that box set was readily available. I was wrong. So,
but, sometimes Kill Baby Kill is a little more. I've heard of Kill Baby Kill before. I'd never heard of The Girl Who Knew Too Much. So, I'm thinking it might be a little more widely available.
It also was a bit. Kill Baby Kill was also. It was released in several different forms in the U.S. It's had a number of titles over the years. Curse of the Dead. Curse of the Living Dead, Don't Walk in the Park, just straight Operation Fear, and a few others. So I think this one's a little bit more widely traveled also than The Girl Who Knew Too Much, despite having no Americans in it, you know, but be that as it may.
What?
No, I mean, there's in the main cast, it's all Europeans. But there's nothing wrong with Europeans, you know. They're
you say so.
I mean, other than the obvious, you know, they're not Americans. So.
So long as they shave their pits, I'm fine with it.
And see.
Oh. Yeah, we're not gonna see any females in bikinis, you know, raising their arms up and seeing, you know, big tufts of hair poking out, are we, Luke? You're not getting us down that track, are you?
No. No.
Thank you. I thank you in advance then, sir.
Doesn't bother me. I grew up around hippie ladies.
Oh.
Ladies, don't let these guys intimidate you into letting that armpit hair grow.
Oh. Oh.
Fashion police.
I think we're out. There we go. Yeah.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Anytime you plan to visit Amazon.com, please be aware that if you use the Amazon.com link located on our website, www.twotruefreaks.libsyn.com, Two True Freaks will receive a referral bonus for any items you purchase. There is absolutely no additional cost to you whatsoever for doing this. All proceeds go directly toward keeping new episodes of all your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated podcasts rolling, and it really helps us out. So please, use our Amazon.com link anytime you plan to visit Amazon.com.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled ScottGardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
And this is your Uncle Don saying good night.
Good night, little kids. Good night.
We're off?
Good. Well, that ought to hold the little bastards.